Thank you, Miriam. More fascinating and certainly evidence that fits together very well about the importance of this early childhood period and what can be done to support it. I'm going to introduce Viva Madiba again. She is from South Africa. She's a senior lecturer and researcher at the School of Public Health and the University of Limpopo and a doctoral candidate. She's worked in various HIV/AIDS projects, and her research focus is in youth reproductive health and behavior change. And she's going to talk about childhood immunization coverage in South Africa. Lessons from the field.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. My paper or my presentation is a collaboration between the Ministry of Health in South Africa, an academic institution, and a vaccine and immunization center. And the collaboration was about trying to understand immunization and better knowing what is happening in communities about immunization. Most of the studies that are conducted or the projects that are carried out are of qualitative work. I have nothing to disclose. In South Africa, I would say South Africa is among the few countries that already have managed to do very well in immunization coverage. For example, we have an expanded program of immunization, which is to protect every child from childhood vaccine preventable diseases and all those diseases that are included in their AP schedule. And the country is really committed in seeing that vaccination and immunization is carried out. It has adopted the global strategy for polio and measles elimination, and the country strives for a 90% national immunization coverage for children. This is what the expanded program of immunization in South Africa looks like, and it covers children from birth up to 5 years. And as I said, we have an expanded program of immunization. Though the expanded program of immunization has been in use for many years, around 2002 it was relaunched with the goals of ensuring that we achieve a 90% coverage for each vaccine in the routine childhood immunization schedule in 80% of the districts in South Africa, and also to ensure that we are polio-free by the end of 2005, and to achieve measles elimination and measles surveillance standard by the end of 2005, and also to make sure that there is response to suspected adverse events of immunization. Okay, and some of the goals have been achieved, but because by 2006, South Africa was declared polio-free. And there has been a number of immunization campaigns, surveillances to ensure that we are really polio-free. So we have been polio-free since 2006. However, we still have some challenges. Even though the country has strived to do well, we have been able to see a number of improvements in the immunization coverage in the country. And there is evidence that we have been able to achieve a national coverage of 90%. However, we still have challenges, especially in the rural areas of South Africa, where around 2003, some provinces in South Africa or rural districts in provinces in South Africa showed a coverage of as low as 43%. We still see erratic measles outbreaks in many of the provinces in South Africa since 2003 and to 2007. We also have a challenge of seeing discrepancies in most of the national immunization coverage data. And if you look at this graph, it shows that in this province, this is one of the provinces in South Africa, Limpopo. This is a rural district, and there is some provinces where the coverage is at 43%. And if you look at this graph, you can see that though we have been measles-free since 2000, around 2003, we started seeing measles outbreaks, and we still have a few cases in 2007. And of concern is the discrepancies or the differences in what the district health information system shows as coverage and what the other data shows. And these are two districts. One is a rural district. Amatoli is a rural district. And it shows the differences in what the national coverage says and what the Statistics South Africa shows. And the other province, Ekurhuleni, is a rural province. There's also some discrepancies in what is reported as coverage. And having said that, around the same time when South Africa relaunched their national expanded program of immunization, the country also established a South African Vaccination and Immunization Center, which is a network of partners in vaccination. If you look at the site, these are the partners that are part of the immunization vaccination network. It is also a public and academic alliance, and it is housed in the university where I'm working. What is this CIVIC all about? CIVIC was established to ensure that there is promotion of immunization in South Africa, besides the fact that also they do research in vaccinology and other things, and also to advocate for increased efforts to reach and maintain high immunization coverage in the country. And also CIVIC supports and strengthens the expanded program of immunization in South Africa. But another important part of this center is that they conduct vaccine and immunization research and also training and education. And there has been some collaborative work. As I said, this is a collaborative work that I'm going to present. There has been a lot of collaborative work between CIVIC and academic and research institutes. And this work that I'm going to present is between the School of Public Health, where I'm working, and CIVIC. And the school, as a partner, identified the need to look at qualitative data to understand immunization and look at the social and behavioral aspects of immunization. And because CIVIC also aimed to improve education, the projects were conducted by MPH students at the School of Public Health. The data that I'm presenting is on a few of these projects, but the projects are ongoing, and there's a number of studies that are still conducted in many areas of vaccinology from the center and the school. What we did is that we conducted studies in four provinces. In fact, we only used sub-districts in these provinces, and two were rural, two were urban. And our population were mothers or caretakers with children aged 10 to 24. We looked at qualitative data where we conducted focus groups, discussions to explore immunization knowledge and practice, and some of the factors which influence immunization coverage. But we also had quantitative data where we did face-to-face interviews to determine factors which influence immunization coverage. And we also looked at some of the immunization coverage data from the provinces. And we find a few things that were quite interesting. For example, we know that the mothers from the urban districts were much better informed. They had better knowledge and understanding of vaccine preventable diseases as compared to mothers from the rural districts. We also learned that the health workers from the urban district were seen as credible sources of information as compared to mothers from the rural districts. Mothers in the urban district felt that they can go to health providers and they will know and they'll learn about vaccine issues. From the rural district, we learned that there were alternative options that were used to protect children against diseases. This ranged from faith-based practices, traditional and cultural practices. And about half of the participants still consulted traditional healers, and use traditional medicine to cure childhood ailments and to keep their babies healthy. There was a lot of use of over-the-counter medications, which is believed to protect children from evil spirits. And in this group, we found that the health sector or the health providers were perceived as the major barrier for immunization uptake. And there were various reasons that were cited by the participants that the healthcare workers are not helpful. But we also learned that the knowledge and of immunization and childhood illnesses was also a social barrier probably to uptake of immunization. The quantitative data, we learned that the reasons that maybe we have so many, we have erratic immunization outbreaks was because there was low second dose measles immunization coverage as compared to the data that we saw from the DHSI. And that was something that we could only get from that. In conclusion, we now know that we cannot make conclusions or draw conclusions on the challenges for immunization uptake and coverage when we only use quantitative data. In a country as diverse as with such diverse communities as South Africa, the quantitative studies provided additional data on the social, cultural, and traditional factors that influence the uptake of childhood immunization in South Africa. And we also now know that the differences in maternal immunization knowledge and the traditional and cultural practices between the urban and rural explains the vast differences in the uptake of immunization between the two settings. We recommend that because the majority of people in South Africa still live in rural areas, it will be important, or it is very important, to address the maternal knowledge on vaccine-preventable diseases when developing public health interventions for promoting childhood vaccination. In South Africa, already materials are developed in the local languages of the communities, but we need to strengthen this. We need to ensure that communities do get to get these materials and they understand the issues around immunization. But also we need to strengthen community mobilization and advocacy to begin to engage communities in who still consult traditional healers for childhood illnesses. Thank you.
And we still have a good 20 plus minutes for discussion. I think I'll ask I was going to try to get this microphone so I can move it around, but I don't think it'll work. So I'm going to ask the panel to come up and speak, and so address, if you have a person that you're addressing your questions to, either comments about the presentations or questions. Yes.
Nothing. Okay, after 6 months. Your question could get me started on about a week-long seminar. In brief, optimal feeding in terms of the child's ability to absorb, in terms of the hormonal interplay, what they call the mother-baby dance of feeding, immediately postpartum for the first 6 months, the skin-to-skin, and feeding on demand is the best way to feed the child, not only for nutritional purposes, but for health outcomes. After that, you do want to add in appropriate, age-appropriate complementary foods and feeding. And the way that feeding occurs greatly influences early childhood attachment. So the active, age-appropriate, active feeding what's the jargon term? But there's a term for interactive feeding where the mother and baby responsive. Feeding is the way to go. The current recommendations for complementary feeding now suggest
that the first foods not be the old rice pablum with iron that we used to give, but rather, if possible, animal protein and fat. Again, that's a whole nother weeks of lectures on complementary feeding. But thank you for raising the issue. I think that what's important is that that people understand the importance of exclusive breastfeeding at the beginning and understand what exclusive means, and then also understand how to introduce these others. My opinion is also that you should breastfeed first before you give the complementary food, because human milk remains the most nutrient-appropriate food for the baby from then on. And then adding these other supplements are just that. They're complementary foods. They complement the breastfeeding. Thank you for the question. Again, being sort of anti-product and global commercial drift, I would say expression of breast milk, if you don't mind. But the reality is that the vast majority, certainly there's special circumstances that, where medically indicated, certainly there can be a separation. But the vast number of births need not have that separation. The mother and the baby can be cared for together in the vast majority. In those where there is separation, severe prematurity, other problems like that. Many NICUs have begun to have as much skin-to-skin as possible in the NICU. In developing settings where there may not be a NICU, skin-to-skin and kangaroo care have shown to be extremely effective in ameliorating the situation, because you have the body temperature, especially when skin-to-skin with the mother. The mother's skin reacts more thermically to the baby being skin-to-skin than does the father's skin. But the father's skin still does help. So there are things that we can do in those severe situations in developing settings. The exclusivity is important for many reasons. Anything other than breast milk introduced, even a little bit, changes the gut flora. And it takes a couple weeks at least for the gut to recover from that insult. Furthermore, the way the gut grows is different with exclusive breastfeeding. You actually have a different shape of the villi and the lumen of the gut. And just to cut to the chase, if you believe at all in epigenetics, that the things that a baby's exposed to influence how its genes are expressed, you have the vast surface of the baby is its gut. The outside skin is actually minimal compared to the gut. What are we putting against that gut? Why in the world are we putting non-human protein against the gut of the newborn? Non-human growth factors, non-human algae-derived chemicals. Doesn't make any sense. But again, another week or so would allow me to fully answer your question. Sorry. Okay. There's nothing wrong with expression when a mother and child must be separated. However, it's not physiological. So it's definitely, again, you're providing the human protein, you're providing the human factors. That's all good, but it's very different on the maternal physiology and the infant physiology. So there is no question that when you can't be together, human expressed milk is the way to go. However, it definitely is not the same, because you don't get that skin-to-skin hormonal interaction. When you're breastfeeding directly, the milk actually changes during the course of the feed. The mother and the child, when they're together, are exposed to the same factors out there, and so the mother's immunities are more directed for the infant, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The second you express milk, it begins to change because it begins digesting itself. So for many reasons, it's not the same, but if separation must exist, in the United States, where we're the only developed country in the world that does not have significant paid maternity leave, this is a reality. And I think what we need is to fight for that paid maternity leave. Thank you.
Thank you for that. Other questions or comments for any of the presenters? Yes, Nancy.
that one of the reasons why the group home, which is more like a foster home, I guess?
Actually, in addition to this psychosocial distress, in other, which I didn't present here, we found that children in group home do the best, not in just these measures, but in many other measures. They always do the best comparing to children in orphanage and children in kinship care. Actually, among these three care arrangements, a group home is the best, second is orphanage, and the worst is kinship care. Because I know there are a lot of literature talking about children may be best taken care of in extended family members. But I think in this particular area, because the poverty issues, most of the time, for instance, like uncles and grandma, they themselves are in big poverty, and they have to take care of their own children. And sometimes they are like unwillingly to take care of this additional orphan, which are not their own child. So that's a problem. And why the group home children do best? As I said, this is a government-sponsored program. Usually they have the volunteers, usually husband and wife. They don't have their own children, but they are willing to kind of like adopt. And the local government pay them money to take care of these children. So they actually work out like a real family. So, and children in orphanage, why they do better than children in kinship care, we visited some of the orphanages because they, after they, infamous, the government-sponsored blood collection incident, received a lot of media attention, so the government tried to do something back to the community, so they actually invested a lot in these orphanages. And also the society, a lot of like college students, they volunteer there, and then the local communities care a lot about the children in orphanage. But by contrast, children in kinship care, they do not. I guess that's why. Mm. Oh, are you asking how do we measure the psychosocial distress?
Yeah, well, you, I think, if I understood correctly, you indicated that you used a number of different
scales.
Areas.
Yes.
Yeah, who did you talk to?
We give the children the surveys. The participants, if I remember correctly, the age range was from 7 years old to 18 years old, with a mean age of 12 years old. So for children who can read and write, they just do that on the survey, but for some younger children, they could not read. We read the questions to them, and then they answer that, and we mark on the survey. Yeah.
Good. Yes, here. You.
Well, that's an interesting question of whether there are differences in attachment with biological families and caregivers. And I think we have not distinguished that in the analysis we've done. But your question suggests it should be done. Nancy, do you want to answer that?
But I remember one of those stories where the
Well, the current thinking is this is still a problem. The reality is that the undervaluing of the mother-child relationships and the undervaluing of breastfeeding has led to a construct where productivity is only money and not a construct in which the society accepts the productivity of breastfeeding. So we really do have an undermining of that period of life and that potential in many settings. And then when you get to the non-formal sector of work, it gets even worse. So I would say that you're raising an issue that still remains a significant barrier. Milk expression doesn't need a pump. And there, if taught, women can express milk and store it even at room temperature until they get home from work. But that is a skill that needs to be taught. We did this in rural Chile. It's not the same as, you know, really, really rural Thailand. But you can express milk and just keep it with you in a container and take it home and have it fed. It's not optimal, but it's better than the alternatives. A lot of work remains to be done. Again, where do we get the funding to do this? There is now a big international movement for called the Business Case for Breastfeeding and Maternity Protection at the Worksite internationally, and perhaps there'll be some concept that this is also societally worthy of protection. Thank you very much for raising that issue.
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Are there any other questions?
I think it's better.
Oh, there was. Okay.
Thank you. My last question is to Julia. You said there's no statistical difference between double offense and single offense. But did you look at among the single offense whether the difference to children who lost their mother versus a child who lost their father?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We didn't do that in this particular study, but I'm definitely going to look at that.
Could you use the microphone, please?
Oh.
She was asking, because in my report, there was no statistically significant difference between double orphan and single orphan in terms of their perceived social support and psychosocial distress. So she's asking, did I look at the difference among the single orphans? Did I look at the difference between children who lost their mother and children who lost their father? So my response is, I didn't do that in this study, but that's definitely a very interesting question. I would take a look at the data. Yeah.
Just one other response to the gentleman in the back. In Gambia, they started baby-friendly communities, and what they did is that women who were breastfeeding or pregnant traded fields with women who had to go really far, and so that during the time that you were pregnant or breastfeeding, you didn't have a long commute. So there's ways that communities can address this too. My question to the other members of the panel, especially with the single orphans, if the mother is there, is anything done to support the exclusive breastfeeding in your program? And in immunization, is anything being done to support? This is exactly the age when mothers should be breastfeeding their children. Is there any breastfeeding support built into your programs? Jack, same question.
I think this is just a general response to what is happening with exclusive breastfeeding, baby-friendly hospitals in South Africa. We are the most of the hospitals are baby-friendly or are in the process of being accredited as baby-friendly. And yes, breastfeeding is promoted, but I wouldn't say that in this research that we've done or in this immunization, it has been built in. But probably it would be one of the best things that we can do.
Yeah, I think in China, particularly in rural China, breastfeeding, it kind of the practice, actually they all do exclusive breastfeeding in the rural area because women actually don't have to commute to work. In our when I visited the site of the study, we found that the government, when they try to prevent the mother to child transmission of HIV, they kind of like stop them from breastfeeding, and then they provide them free a formula That's what they actually did. And then we saw that when we did the site visit. Yeah.
In the short.
Why don't you introduce yourself?
Oh, yeah, I'm Nancy Bryant, and one of the authors with Jack on this paper. In the survey that we did in our community, we have mostly vulnerable children as opposed to lots of orphans. But we found that when asking the caregiver of the child under 5 years of age about breastfeeding, we found very few were doing exclusive breastfeeding. It was really discouraging to hear that. I think it was maybe only 18% of the all the children who were under two. Now, the traditional thing is most people think about in African countries, the baby is always on the back or the front. But when the women have to work, they can't carry the baby with them all the time and can't do that breastfeeding. And so they were giving additional food starting with 3 months. And I'm not talking about a formula because they couldn't afford formula, but they're giving them some kind of a meal or porridge or something. And that's sooner than we give it here. I think it's still 6 months, isn't it? And so that's not very good, and those are things we have to address with it. But a lot of them continued to breastfeed in the morning or the evening, but it wasn't exclusive breastfeeding the way you were discussing. So it's not so good, but it's better than nothing. So just...
Thank you. Any last questions? A comment.
It's just a comment to follow up on what you just said. In our culture, it wouldn't be culturally right or culturally acceptable for somebody to express their milk and put it in the fridge in the home and go to work and expect we don't do that. It would not be acceptable. That is why expressing milk, it's not an option that you try to teach women in Africa. It is not culturally acceptable. I don't know whether to say it's not culturally acceptable because it is in the culture, but it would not be acceptable to, maybe I can do it in my home, but it would not be done in many, many households.
But I think it is a great reminder of some of the barriers to these optimal practices that we're talking about. I'd really like to thank this excellent panel for both new information, stimulating information, and also reminding us of a lot of things that we probably already knew and need to keep remembering. So thank you very, very much.
Okay, good.
How are things?
You know, good. I was trying to come up to Seattle at the end of November, but the guy I was going to meet, yeah, November 24th, but the guy I was going to meet now has to go to D.C. Somebody had passed I was going to meet with. So it'll probably be December now. But
you will be coming?
But I want, yeah, and I'll get in touch with you guys.
New office from when you were there
do
before.
You?
Oh,
wow. Yes. Bigger, better, same, oh, God, the, yes. Still we the
had,
university? Or?
We had those, you know, that small, I remember we were there, that sort of small office.